Hi, everyone. I'm Deb Flaschenberg. Welcome to Yoga, Birth, Babies, a podcast produced by Prenatal Yoga Center. We will be diving into everything prenatal yoga, birth, and baby-related, hoping to inspire, educate, and empower you through your journey into motherhood. Thank you for listening.
For my yoga teacher friends who are interested in working with the pregnant population, Prenatal Yoga Center offers an 85-hour Yoga Alliance certified program based on our three-pronged theory of prenatal yoga: asana, education, and community. Once a year, we hold our three-month immersion program in New York City. For those who cannot attend this training, Caprice and I are now traveling to different locations holding our training at hosting studios where we will spend 6 days working together, exploring and learning about prenatal yoga. This training consists of more than 50 hours working together. We also created a whole membership website with more than 20 videos corresponding directly to the manual you will receive. For more information, check out our website at prenatalyogacenter.com. Hope to work with you soon. Take care.
Hi, everyone. I'm Deb, and I am your host for Yoga Birth Babies. And today we have Dr. Stuart Fishbein, and we're going to talk about VBACs and breech and vaginal twin births and just stuff that maybe you wouldn't think to ask your care provider about. So let me tell you about a little bit about Dr. Fishbein. Dr. James Fishbein, MD, was board certified in 1989 and became a fellow of the American College of Obstetrics and Gynecology in 1990. He's been a practicing obstetrician in Southern California since completing his residency in 1986. While well-trained at Cedars-Sinai Medical Center in the standard medical care of obstetrics, he had the respect and vision to support the midwifery model of care and serve as a backup consultant to many home and birth center midwives for 25 years. In 1996, he found the Women's Place for Health, a collaborative practice of certified nurse midwives and obstetricians in Camarillo, California. In 2004, Dr. Fishbein co-authored the book Fearless Pregnancy and Wisdom and Reassurance from a Doctor, a Midwife, and a Mom. He has spoken internationally on breech and vaginal births after cesarean sections and has appeared in multiple documentaries. Dr. Fishbein now works directly with home birth midwives and offers hope for women who prefer and respect a natural birthing environment and cannot find supportive practitioners for VBAC, twin, and breech deliveries. He recently published a paper, Home Birth with an Obstetrician, a Series of 135 Births, critically analyzing his home birth statistics. Dr. Fishbein has a goal of reteaching the skills such as breech and twin vaginal births that make the specialty of obstetrics unique. Thank you so much for joining me. How are you today?
Deb, I'm great. It's a pleasure to be on your show and to talk about topics that are very dear to me.
Oh, wonderful. Well, let's get started with a little bit of just about how did you get into, what led you to practicing and supporting VBACs and breech and vaginal twin births?
I was lucky enough to be training in an era where those things were common and they were the standard of care. I trained in the early 80s. I did my residency at Cedars-Sinai here in Los Angeles. And as part of our training, we spent 4 months or more at LA County USC Women's Hospital, which at that time was the busiest hospital in the country. They were doing about 22,000 births a year, which comes out to be about 65 births a day. And there were about 9 to 12 people on the team, some interns, medical students, residents, and one senior resident. So we got to see pretty much everything. And in those days, breech births were you know, considered a variation of normal, and it was part of your training. And so when VBAC wasn't considered, it was a non-issue. I mean, it was just a vaginal birth and twins and all that stuff. We just got well-trained. When I came out, I was doing all the things that I was trained to do. And slowly but surely, I would tell you that the hospitals and I just, we sort of just had a falling of the ways. They continued to restrict options and choices that really didn't belong to them to restrict, in my opinion. And unfortunately, I'm not a sheep, and I just had a trouble. I had trouble accepting rules that didn't make any sense to me, nor denied women their you know, God-given right to make informed decisions based on reasonable options. And so it just came to the point where, about 2010, I was going to get to a place where I was going to have to fight the hospital for the right to continue to do breeches and twins and VBACs and work with midwives. I'd had a certified nurse midwife collaborative practice at that time in Ventura County, California, and they didn't really like us from the beginning. And it got very, personal and political. And you have to realize that when you're small, you are going to lose generally to somebody who's big. And the battle would have been that even if I had won what I wanted to win, was the right to stay practicing at that hospital, they would have still restricted me from doing the things that I wanted to do. So all I would have won was the right to stay at a place that wasn't going to allow me to practice as I knew how to practice. So I left and I went into the home birthing world. And I've been doing these things at home, much to the delight of the people that I have the chance to offer this to. I've been promoting it. I've been writing. I'm speaking. I've written a book. I had a paper published a couple years ago on home birthing with an obstetrician. And, unfortunately, there's so much literature out there that's against it. But it's all that literature is really not based on anything scientific. It's all based on consensus opinion. So I'm going to just do as long as I can practice, I'm going to continue to practice to advocate for what I truly believe are evidence-based options that belong to the individual woman to make that decision, not for an institution or a doctor or an insurance company to do that.
It's interesting. I know of a lot of home birth midwives, but I don't actually know, at least in this area, of any obstetricians that do home birth. So it's really unique that you're doing that, and it's wonderful for the people in your area.
Yeah, well, there aren't very many of us, and part of it is that doctors don't have the need to work at home because they have the hospital to work at. Part of it is that doctors really wouldn't know what to do if they didn't have the security blanket of an anesthesia department and a pediatric department or a NICU team available, or with all the interventions that they have. They really don't know much. I didn't know much about natural birthing, normal birthing, and I would say that at least 85% of women really are normal and really don't need anything other than the beautiful care that a midwife provides. So I think, it's part of it is fear, part of it is ignorance, part of it is the system, and much to the, I have empathy for my doctor friends who are under immense pressure, both economic and medical, legal, and expedient pressures to practice in a system that they have very little control over anymore. And they just really, all they want to do is sort of go to work, make a livelihood, go home, love their kids and their wife and or their husband or their spouse, I should say, and then go back to work the next day. And they really don't want to buck the system. This is true in many aspects of our lives, but is really true in obstetrical care. I don't know really what made me different. I think that you have to really look back at my childhood and growing up with my parents and my mother and all that stuff that made me want to stand up for what's right.
Well, it's wonderful that you did. So I want to talk a little bit about the idea of VBACs and breech and vaginal twin birth. So these skills seem to be getting a little extinct from what I can see as a doula and a childbirth educator, and I've been working with pregnant women for about 15 years. Why do you think this is happening?
Well, I don't want to lump them all together, so
okay.
Let's break them apart.
Sure.
Let's talk about VBAC because...
Great.
VBAC, there are skills that you need to recognize when something might be going wrong with a VBAC. But other than that, a VBAC doesn't require any specific skills in training or delivery technique that you might associate with breech or twin delivery. So I don't want to lump that in there. It always is lumped in there, and it's sort of a mistake to do that because VBAC is really just a normal vaginal birth. And the evidence, including the evidence from organized medicine, even the American College of OBGYN and the National Institute of Health, support VBAC after one and even two C-sections. And for hospitals to ban that, despite overwhelming evidence that it's reasonable and supported by these organizations, just seems completely unethical to me.
Mm-hmm.
Why they do it? Well, they do it because of the decisions aren't really being made between doctor and patient anymore. They're being made by insurance companies, risk managers, hospital administrators, and doing what's best for the bottom line. And in some cases, the way the system works, hospitals pay more, get paid more for a C-section than they do for a vaginal birth. And if the fiduciary duty of the hospital CEO or CFO is to increase profitability of the hospital, then there's absolutely no incentive for them to lower the cesarean section rate. They'd be biting off their nose to spite their face. Now, that sounds terrible to those of us that look at ethics from a different point of view, But I understand where that's coming from. The way to resolve that issue easily for VBAC would be to change the reimbursement model. And if insurance companies just said, you know what, we're not going to pay anything different, or we're going to actually pay more for a vaginal birth, you would suddenly see VBAC become the most popular thing on the planet. So it doesn't, it isn't really about safety. Mm-hmm. Safety in all these issues, which we'll talk about with breech and twin in a second, what I consider a canard. It's a false argument. They will always use that to get you to do what they want to do. You can look at the vaccine issue. You can look at the motorcycle helmet law. You can look at all these things, and they'll always use safety to try to drive you. And once they play the injured baby card, no mother is going to argue with that. Mm-hmm. So we have to sort of change the way we think. And VBAC is something that should be universally accepted, and it's not. And that's something that seems actually to be getting worse than better. And many hospitals are just, you know, they're putting their back up, and they're almost recalcitrant in trying to negotiate with them regarding this sort of thing. So until we have a paradigm shift, we're not going to see much change in the way VBAC is done. Maybe it'll require tort reform, maybe not. I'm sorry.
I was just going to ask a question. So I've had students have had, you know, a cesarean, and they're considering a VBAC, and they want to know the benefits of a VBAC. How would you describe that? They're saying, like, you know, I had a cesarean, I can just have another one, it's easy, I already have a baby at home, it makes my scheduling easy. What would you say to that student?
Okay. Well, I would say that the risks of a second cesarean section are not very high, but the risks of a vaginal delivery are not very high either. So, you know, we're talking about small risk when we're talking about risk. But if they really want the information, more than I can summarize here in the next minute or so, they should go to Jen Campbell's website, VBAC Facts. That's mm-hmm. VBACFACTS.com, and they can get all the detailed data. But just look at it this way. If for any reason, depending on how many children you want, say you had a C-section for your first baby, and you say, what's the risk in the second baby? Well, the risk of a neonatal death or an injury to your baby is higher if you've had that first C-section. So the key really is to avoid the first C-section, which is what we'll get to when we talk about breech and twins in a second, or unnecessary inductions and that sort of thing. But once you've had that first C-section, with each subsequent C-section, there's more risk to the mother and more risk to the baby. The risks to the babies include the uterus possibly rupturing, and with each successive C-section, that gets higher. Now, if a woman says, I'm only going to have two babies, it's my second baby, I'm going to have a second C-section, that's it, one could argue that is a reasonable choice if she's given the information about the risk, which include wound infection, more likely hemorrhage, possible bowel obstruction or chronic pain, poor wound healing, slower recovery, more problems with breastfeeding, all those things that can go on over long term, plus the risk to the baby, which may be things about the microbiome. It might have to do with exposure to bacteria at birth and not getting, you know, colonized with the right bacteria, which can maybe lead to chronic autoimmune issues or diabetes or childhood asthma. There's a link to all these things. Again, we're not talking about big risks, so I don't want to be accused of emphasizing just the bad things, because then I'd be as bad as the people that are trying to talk you out of the choices that are reasonable.
No, I think it's important for people to know that there are risks to both sides, because I feel like some things are sold that cesareans are so commonplace that it's not really taken consider. It's major abdominal surgery, and that risk should be considered.
Oh, I think the informed consent process is so skewed in a doctor's office. I mean, they'll talk about all the risks of a VBAC, but then they'll tell you about a repeat C-section. Oh, that's nothing. You know, you'll be in, you'll be out. You'll be home in a couple of days. It's, you know, it takes 40 minutes to do it. It'll be nothing to it. The other thing about that is if you plan to have a third or a fourth baby, then avoiding that second C-section it becomes more and more significant, because the risks with a second C-section are, you know, then you have the risk of a third C-section, which are slightly greater than the second, and the risk of a fourth. And if you're, you know, a family that wants four or five kids, you really need to think about trying to avoid surgical birth, because it does put you more at risk down the road.
What are
now,
some,
there are, Oh, go ahead.
Well, what are some of the parameters that a woman should know who would like a VBAC? For example, like how far past her due date can she negotiate? And does she need to be concerned about, you know, fetal weight? Because that's something that tends to creep up, that the student may hear from her care provider, oh, yeah, sure, you can have a VBAC. But then we start to get close to her due date and the story changes a bit.
Yeah, you hear that all the time. We call it the bait and switch. But what it really is that the practitioner who's not comfortable with VBAC will find reasons to make VBAC more uncomfortable for you. So they will decide that your baby is getting too big, or we don't want you going overdue. There's no data to support that. There's no data to support that at all. There's no data to support that if you go at 41 weeks, you're more likely to rupture than you are in labor at 39 weeks. I mean, the skewing of data to get people, to funnel you down a path that they want you to take. So the key is to find a practitioner that truly is VBAC friendly and not somebody who's going to tolerate your VBAC.
So are there ways that a pregnant woman could identify that early?
Well, one of the things they can do is I've always told people, and the same thing I tell people when they move to a new town, they say, how do I find a good obstetrician? And I say, well, call labor and delivery and speak to the nurses.
That's smart.
All right. So call the labor and delivery at local labor and delivery hospital and just get chummy with one of the nurses on the phone and say, listen, I'm new in town, or I'm looking for a VBAC-friendly doctor. If you were pregnant and needed a VBAC, who would you go to? And then you ask around, and nurses love to talk about that sort of thing. They just do. And they know. And they, some of them may be handcuffed or not want to talk about it, but most of them don't feel like there's a problem with being honest. And so they'll tell you. You also, you can sometimes tell just by when you meet them. I mean, we're good at reading people, and you go in for an interview and you ask the questions, and if they respond normally to the questions, openly and honestly, and have a discussion with you, that's great. But if they're hurrying you out the door, or they start to roll their eyes or take a deep breath or sigh, you know, it's like, okay, you know, maybe this isn't the right fit for me. It's very hard to change. We have long relationships sometimes with our gynecologists, and we just assume that because they've been doing my pap smears and birth control for 10 years, now I'm pregnant, that's the same person I should go to for obstetrics. You have to sometimes be tougher in that and make a break.
What would make someone a good candidate for a VBAC?
Pregnant.
All right. So it's not, you know, one thing I've had people say is like, oh, you know, I got to the pushing stage before and baby was too big, they say. I personally usually believe it's not baby too big. I usually think it's baby malpositioned. But, you know, so I've had some pushback, or I've had students say I went all the way to 42 weeks and I got induced and I had a cesarean, and they have many reasons. So is there anything that would risk someone out for trying to be back?
Yeah, I mean, a classical cesarean section would risk you out. If you've had a myomectomy where they've gone through and through all the way into the endometrial cavity, that should risk you out. But short of that, there are very few risks to a woman who's trying to have a VBAC after a first-time low transverse cesarean section rate. I mean, cesarean section. The rates of success are variable. You know, if you had a C-section because your first baby was breech and nobody offered you a vaginal option, and you had then you have about an 80% chance of success, according to the NIH, with a VBAC in the second pregnancy, if you go to a VBAC-friendly institution. Now, that brings up a whole other can of worms, because the way you're treated in a hospital setting is that when you come in for a VBAC, is you're treated as if you're a can of TNT about to explode. And so you're not allowed to eat. You're usually not allowed to move. You have to be on continuous monitoring. You often have to have an epidural just in case something happens. And so what they're doing is they're setting you up to fail, which is what I've found in my experience now. I've been doing home birthing now for 7 years, and my VBAC success rate is over 90% at home. And that's because I think we just allow women to labor and move and eat and drink and not be interrupted and not feel stressed, those sorts of things. So even the success rate in hospitals with VBAC is often much less than you would see with a midwifery practice. If you look at the MANA statistics versus some of the stated statistics of hospitals, you'll find that it's much higher. And so there really are no contraindications to having a cesarean, to having a VBAC. Some people will say, well, if you got pregnant within 6 months of your last of delivering, that's a risk factor. And yes, it is a risk factor. And some people will look at scar thickness, and I think the data on that is pretty poor. Some people will say, you know, if you're macrosomic or if you're breech or if you're whatever, you shouldn't have a VBAC. But that's actually not what's supported. Some people will say if you've had two C-sections, you shouldn't have a VBAC. That's not supported in literature. Even ACOG admits that VBAC after two C-sections is a reasonable choice. So it really is, it comes down to essentially, you know, if you're pregnant and if you want to try for a VBAC, the main risk that you have is that, you know, there's a 20% chance that it won't be successful and you'll end up with a repeat C-section. And the maternal morbidity for that is slightly greater than if you would have had a scheduled repeat cesarean section. But there are people like Michelle O'Donnell who think that allowing the baby to decide its due date and waiting for labor to occur, even if you were planning a repeat C-section, is better for the baby. Your doctors won't like that very much because they'll pull out the ruptured uterus risk card, but they all really don't like it because they can't schedule you for 7:30 in the morning on a Tuesday. You might go into labor at 10 o'clock at night or 2 o'clock in the morning on a Saturday night, and they're not happy about that. So but ultimately, that might be better for the baby.
So out of curiosity, in the way that you practice, so some of the guidelines that I see here in New York City for VBACs is they don't let them go too far past their due date, and yet they don't allow induction. So I'm just curious, how do you work with going, how far into pregnancy does your practice go with?
Okay, good question. First of all, there is no contraindication using Pitocin in a VBAC. That, again,
is starting,
also
like starting completely from scratch?
Yes, it's supported by ACOG in that as long as there's a proper medical indication for induction, not just because you're 40 weeks and 5 days,
okay,
that sort of thing. I don't have a problem with people going past their due date because their due date is a very poor indicator of when you're due. Only about 8% of people deliver on their due date, so about half the people deliver after their due date. So are we going to say that something that's more than 92% wrong is something we should be relying on? And the answer to that is an easy no, we shouldn't. So I don't use 42 weeks. We got a lot of stuff to cover here today because I got a lot in my head. But, you know, they start doing testing on babies. It used to be they started at 42 weeks where they do a biophysical profile, which is an ultrasound to look at certain parameters around the baby, including fluid, and a non-stress test, which is where you wear the belts for 20 minutes or half an hour, and they look at the heart rate. And then they moved it to 41 weeks, and then they moved it to 40 weeks in one day, and then some doctors are even doing it earlier. And I won't even get into the reasons why, but we've already talked a little bit about the economic forces and stuff like that. There's no reason not to do it. And if you're looking for a reason to induce, you start looking for a reason to induce. So you'll find one if you start looking for it. But if you start doing the testing, and we know that the testing is pretty accurate data on this, that says if it's normal, like 10 out of 10, the chance of your baby having an adverse event in the next 3 to 4 days is pretty unlikely. I mean, very unlikely, far less than 1%. So if that's true at 40 weeks, why isn't that true at 42 weeks? If the testing is good at 42 weeks, there's no reason you can't wait till 42 weeks and 3 days to test again. There's nothing magic about 42 weeks. It's an arbitrary number that's 2 standard deviations above the mean and therefore was picked as a number set as a cutoff. It's like the same thing you might see with age 35. What's the significance of age 35? Nothing. Nothing. It has nothing to do with increasing your risk over age 34 or age 36 or anything like that. The biological clock doesn't suddenly just start breaking down at 35. It's an arbitrary number because medicine and doctors and stuff, they like parameters. That it makes them feel more comfortable to have parameters. The other number that I always talk about is 24 hours, and that's talking about ruptured membranes. Do bacteria suddenly know that 24 hours is up and start multiplying at that time? Or, you know, if a woman develops a fever at 6 hours, that's a problem. If she's ruptured her membranes and it's been 3 days and there's no fever and nobody's examined her, that's not a problem.
Well, I thought that the placenta does start to deteriorate around 42 weeks, or is that just something to keep an extra eye out for?
That's what you're testing for. The signs of placental deterioration are going to be diminished urine output on the baby. They're going to see amniotic fluid decreasing. And by the way, amniotic fluid decreasing is not a reason to induce.
Right.
All right? Mm-hmm. Because amniotic fluid, as toward term, always begins to decrease. So again, if you have a doctor that is nervous, a doctor that is trying to get you to do what they want you to do, they'll always talk about, look at the fluid drop from 10 to 8. All right? It's on its way down. We better do something before. Well, 8 is normal. Mm-hmm. 7 is normal. 6 is normal. 5 is normal. Some people say one pocket of 2 centimeters is normal. It really depends on which, you know, guidelines you're using. But diminishing fluid is not in and of itself a reason to be induced.
Now, I'm glad people are hearing this because I hear this all the time. Low fluid level, they want to induce. And I usually say, see if you can wait a day. You know, I always am trying to offer women a little space. I want to shift a little bit to, first of all, great information on the VBACs. And I think that's going to give of women a lot of information to take to their care provider. Because I think if they can come up with evidence-based research to say, this is what I'm studying, this is what I'm learning, how do you work with that? And hopefully they can find a care provider that supports that. So let's talk a little bit about breech. This actually came up in my, I do a teacher training, and we were recently talking about breech. And it's just, at least again, in my area, I'm in New York City, there's very few care providers that do breech births. So I think maybe two. One of the teacher trainees asked why, and I said, it's just not a skill that's taught. And she said, well, why? So let me ask you, why is it not taught so much? Or is it not taught, or is there more of a fear around it? If you don't mind talking a little bit about that.
Well, there's a documentary that I'm involved in called Heads Up, The Disappearing Art of Breech Delivery. It's about 30 minutes long. And if people want to get into a little bit more story about breech birth, that would be a good documentary to go. You can go to headsupfilm.com, I think, is where you can find it.
I'll put all this in our show notes. Great.
And I will just say the training of breech delivery began to decline in the late 80s and early 90s. There were some articles that came out that said that the risk might be higher. And so the skills began to the residency programs began to not teach them, or women were counseled that maybe a C-section is better for it. And then in 2000, a paper out of Vancouver was published in The Lancet called the Term Breech Trial. And in that trial, they found that women whose babies were born by vaginal breech birth had more morbidities than women whose babies were born by cesarean. And their conclusion was that cesarean for breech babies was better in the long run. And so, interestingly enough, most of the time when a scientific paper comes out with some new information, people will wait until other papers confirm that before they jump on the bandwagon and start changing everything, all right? But not this paper. This paper confirmed what people wanted to believe, which was that breech birth was bad, we're going to do C-sections, and it made everybody's life easier, and doctors were happier, and I don't know about residency programs. I mean, it's still a skill that should be taught, whether it's accepted or not. It's an emergency skill, because women are still going to show up in the delivery room or labor and delivery with a butt sticking out of the vagina, and no one's going to know what to do. And so to not teach it is, to me, a real failure of our academicians teaching future residents to do this. However, getting back to the term breech trial, the data was then looked at over the next couple of years, and they found that it was the material and methods of this study were really bad. And there's a paper by a man named Eric Glazerman. He's a researcher from Israel who basically refuted the term breech trial. They did things like they didn't differentiate between planned and unplanned breech deliveries. They sometimes randomized people into breech deliveries while they were in labor and didn't give the woman a choice. They didn't exclude anomalies. The part of the protocol was that all babies were to have an ultrasound prior to randomizing them into the breech group to make sure the baby's heads were flexed. Well, 30% of the babies that were in the breech group never had an ultrasound. The skill of the practitioner was never considered in this study. There was never any control for that. So there were so many flaws in the study that they felt that the recommendations of the term breech trial should be reversed. However, they weren't. And since 2000, most residency programs in the world no longer teach breech delivery. They take them all to cesarean section. Even when a woman shows up completely dilated with the butt beginning to crown at the introitus, they will still push the baby back up inside and take the baby out abdominally, which is kind of interesting because they still have to do a breech delivery even though they're doing it from the abdomen. And I always just assume they think they can cut a bigger hole in case there's a problem. Because the big fear is obviously that the head's going to get stuck. But if you're well-trained in breech delivery, when you're talking about term, we're not talking about extreme premature babies or anything like that. We're talking about term breech deliveries. If you know what you're doing, the chance of the head getting stuck is extremely small.
So you're
nothing is ever
that
zero.
It's just not being taught But how would someone say there is a resident out there that's like, wow, this sounds interesting. I want to learn this. How do they learn this skill so that when you do have the emergency person show up with a breech situation, they don't have to traumatize the woman more by pushing her baby back up through the birth canal to do a cesarean?
Well, it's going to be very difficult for them. You know, they can go to their residency director and say, we want to learn this skill. And the resident director will say, well, we're not doing it. And that's generally what will happen. And then the resident has no power. I mean, the resident can take an elective and possibly go, you know, there aren't that many places in the world, but there's a place in Frankfurt, Germany. There's a place in Sydney, Australia, possibly one in Ottawa, Canada, where you could probably apply to do a, you know, 6 week or 3 month rotation and maybe get some breech training. There's also breech training courses and breech conferences that go on every year. They just had one a couple weeks ago in Sheffield, England, where all the, you know, all the brilliant luminaries in breech come to present their data and discuss issues. And they also have training sessions there where they use these they're not dummies anymore. What do you call them? They're pelvises. They're
like
trainers.
A mannequin. Okay.
Yeah, they're like mannequin trainers, and they've made them, you know, there's some of them are really good right now, and you can learn to do the maneuvers with someone who knows what they're doing, so that just like you train to do maneuvers in a shoulder dystocia, and you learn that in residency program, you train with trainers to do that, because you're not going to wait till you have your first shoulder dystocia to try to learn how to do that. They should be training residents to do breech delivery so that in those rare cases where a woman comes in that way, and even if they don't normally allow, you know, planned vaginal breech delivery, they're going to end up with some people. About a third of women in the Sheffield conference, the guy speaking from, I think it was in the Oxford area, and he said about a third of the women that come into labor and delivery with a breech baby do so, it's undiagnosed until they're in labor. And so you need to know how to do these things, and it's very difficult. I have midwives that come with me to breech births, and there are some midwives I work with now for many years who could probably do breech deliveries just fine, except in my state it's illegal for a midwife to do a breech birth.
So is the main concern of risk is that the cervix, after the butt's born and the torso's born, that the cervix is going to close around the neck? That's the main concern?
That's the main false concern.
Because does a cervix close that quickly?
No.
I mean, because once the shoulders are out, it's pretty.
Well, the shoulder's not in. Once the shoulder's out, the head isn't in the uterus anymore anyway. It's in the vagina.
Yeah.
The worry is that people don't know what to do and they pull on the baby and the baby then extends its neck. And
oh,
then,
I see what you're saying.
And
okay.
It has to deliver by flexion. You know, babies, head first babies deliver by extension.
Mm-hmm.
Breech babies deliver by flexion. They know what to do. And there are maneuvers that you learn. And then the worst case scenario is, at least when I was training, I learned to put on what are called Piper forceps. So I've had to use Piper forceps, I think, 3 times in the last 7 years. On breech babies, and I haven't used any probably in the last 5 years because the new techniques are women laboring mostly or delivering mostly on all fours, and then you have gravity working for you rather than against you, and the baby's heads will just naturally flex if you know the main theory about it is keep hands off the breech, don't be pulling, don't be tugging. Now, obviously, when you're trained, you end up having to do certain things because you know what you're doing. But if you didn't know what you were doing, the best thing to do is let the baby deliver on its own, and they generally will. And if the head doesn't come, then there are certain maneuvers that you can learn that are not difficult to learn. You certainly could learn them with a mannequin, and then you'd know. And I think any OB doctor coming out of a residency program who hasn't been trained in breech delivery, whether it's a singleton breech or a second twin breech or whatever else, really is shortchanging themselves, because if I wanted to be a specialist in a specialty, I'd want to know how to do all the things that specialty is supposed to do.
Mm-hmm.
We're training doctors now to be able to do, I know this is a terrible sort of metaphor, but we're training them to do pap smears and C-sections. And everything else in between is referred to somebody else. All right.
Going a little off subject, do you think that's because of fear of the doctor getting sued? Do you think that's the main reason that they're staying a little more risk-free, I guess, or adverse to risk?
I think it is the academician and the administrator and the risk manager's view that that's true. I think it's, like I said earlier, I think it's a canard. I think it's a false truth. I think the reason people get sued mostly is because the system doesn't generally allow for good relationships between doctor and patient anymore. I don't know a lot of midwives that get sued. I mean, they do, and there's some, and I've been involved in reviewing some, but it's very rare. But I think the way the system is designed for physicians now is, in order to have a better life, you work a shift, you get a salary, you deliver people you've never met before. The people you've taken care of all through their pregnancy are being delivered by a different doctor who they've never met before. You could be caring for someone in labor, and then 7 a.m. rolls around and off the nurse goes, off the doctor goes, a whole new team comes on that doesn't provide for a lot of relationship to develop. And then if there's a misunderstanding or something is confusing, then there's some anger. And we have systems which don't really deal with anger very well. And so what happens is people clam up, the hospital circles its wagons, and the only way for a parents to get information sometimes is to hire a lawyer. And it ends up becoming a self-fulfilling prophecy. Mm-hmm. Absence of true negligence, everybody understands that all medical things don't always have perfect outcomes. I mean, to assume that they do is a mistake. And if you have good communication with people, you can give them this information weeks and weeks ahead of time. You can talk about the possible choices.
Mm-hmm. Well,
when you show up in a hospital and you meet and somebody who you've never met before is taking care of you and really doesn't really want to be there and can't wait for 7 in the morning so that he or she can go home, it doesn't build for a good system to avoid liability. So liability becomes the hammer by which people are pounded back into place.
Well, are there any reasons, if say someone finds a care provider that will do a breech vaginal birth, is it also baby position of breech that's going to determine if that's a good idea or not? Like, because there's different types of breech, or are you game on all sorts of breech? Is it only frank breech that you would do vaginal?
I'm sorry, my daughter just texted me from Barcelona, so I had to respond to her.
No worries.
Frank and complete breech are both reasonable options. Yeah. Frank breech is where the feet are up by the face. It's sort of like where both the hips and knees are extended. The knees are extended and they're flexed in a complete breech birth.
Yeah, so the tissue's
and then the head
down.
Must be flexed. And then the estimated fetal weight should be, looking at the criteria, should be between about 5 and 9 pounds, and maybe 9 1/4 pounds. I don't follow hard and fast rules because I know estimated fetal weights are often misleading. And I think labor will progress for a breech mom the same way it does for a head first mom. They will succeed or not succeed for the same reasons. Not because the baby is breech, but because labor itself sometimes doesn't go smoothly. Mm-hmm. When a woman who's head first has a labor that stalls out, she has the option, especially in home birth, of option of going to the hospital for an epidural and Pitocin. All right. When a breech labor stalls out, most people, well, first of all, they don't have much option in the hospital, but if they were doing it at home and were transported to the hospital, they know they're going in for a cesarean because nobody's going to give them an epidural and Pitocin.
Mm-hmm.
Baby shouldn't have any anomalies. Mother should have an adequate pelvis, which is a vague thing that's defined by, if a woman's already had a baby, we know their pelvis is adequate. If they haven't been run over by a pickup truck, then they probably still have an adequate pelvis. And every woman deserves a trial of labor. It's very unusual for a woman to grow a baby inside of her that won't come out. And yes, it happens sometimes, but rarely does it happen where it's a 911 sort of emergency, either in the hospital. I think a lot of the times we see these dramatic rushing down the hallway, crash cesarean sections. And often those almost always happen in women who have been laboring for a really long time on Pitocin with an epidural. They haven't eaten anything. And the baby and the mom are both worn out. Mm-hmm. And so things give out. We don't really see that sudden deterioration in the home birthing world. It's pretty rare. So if you follow those criteria for breech births, my success rate with women who've already had one baby and their next baby is breech or the third baby is breech is 100%. Multiparous breech moms, to do a C-section on a woman for a breech baby who's had like two vaginal births before and now her third baby's breech, that to me is malpractice. All right? That is malpractice. And to not offer that woman, I can understand it. It's ethical to say to a woman, a breech birth is a reasonable option for you, but I don't know how to do it. So why don't you research somebody else and see what you find out and then come back and talk to me about it. That would be good. But to say to a woman, your baby's breech, it's too dangerous, you should have a C-section, That is negligent.
Now, I'd love to hear doctors say that. I have yet to hear a care provider say, it's just a skill I don't know. I'd suggest you look elsewhere.
Right.
Or suggest, hey, this doctor does that. We even had that situation with external cephalic version that in one hospital, it's done a ton. There's this one doctor who is just known for it. And so if the mother is working in that hospital, you know, with a care provider,
yep,
she's more likely to get that as opposed to some of the other hospitals in the city where they don't have this particular practice, which kind of drives me crazy that a lot of doctors don't even suggest it or say, oh, it's really dangerous. What's your thought on the external cephalic version if they have a care provider that won't do a breach?
Well, if their only other option is to have a cesarean section, then I think it's worth a try. I think the risks are extremely small with aversion. I think the success rates in certain circumstances are also very small. So in my practice, if I have a woman who's having her first baby and that baby's been frank breech for 6 weeks or 8 weeks or longer, because we don't even know how long it's been, and the fluid level is on the lower end of normal, and she's got good muscle tone, or she has an anterior placenta, I would tell her that don't even bother trying, because the success rate is going to be less than 5 or 10%. All right. Now, if it's a second woman who's having her third baby, and then versions are much easier. And about 88% of my breech moms who go into labor with me are first-time moms. And that's not because there are more breeches. Well, there are probably more breeches in first-time moms, but not that many more. It's because the multips, you can get those babies to turn.
Mm-hmm.
And then there's all sorts of tricks and things that – I wouldn't call them tricks. That's the wrong word. But all sorts of exercises and things that you can do before you succumb to the idea that I'm stuck having a cesarean because no one will do breech, including the Spinny Babies website,
yeah,
and chiropractic and moxibustion, acupuncture, and all those things.
Yeah, we suggest that. I mean, actually, I had a podcast with Gail Tully, so I'm all about, you know, go to Spinning Babies, listen to her stuff, all the Webster technique, so we really do try to give the mom the option, because not many of the care providers will do the external cephalic version or breech. So we try to give her, and I guess, you know, not tricks, maneuvers, you know, options.
And right. And if your doctor doesn't do a lot of external cephalic versions, then they should seek out somebody that does them. Most doctors will be honest. I will tell you, they'll be honest. If you ask them, how many have you done? They'll probably be honest with you. Some have an ego and will not be honest with you and will overstate their credentials. But most doctors are honest, and I think we can read people when they're being honest or not. And you should ask them, like, who's the best person to do this? Again, if you don't really know, again, you could call the hospital labor and delivery nurses, because most versions in hospital-based practices are done in the hospital. Mm-hmm. They're done with an anesthesiologist standing by or an operating room standing by. I don't do them that way. I do them in people's homes or in my office because I'm, you know, with informed consent, I'm telling them that the likelihood that you're going to have success is going to be better when you're not in a fear-based world, and the likelihood that you're going to have a problem with aversion when I'm doing it the way I've been doing it for 30-some years is very, very small. So that's the option. If they choose they'd rather do it in a hospital setting, then I would refer them to somebody to do it, because I don't go to hospitals.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm very open with people. When people come to me for a consult, I not only do I talk about the options with me, but I talk about all other options, because I only want people in my practice who came to me because they really want me, not because they thought they had to have me.
Right. No, that's great. I want to talk a little bit in our remaining time about twin vaginal births, because this too does not happen too often. We get, we see actually a lot of twins. I don't know, in our population, again, in New York City, a lot of twins, and a small handful will end up having vaginal twin. What option does a mom have if, I guess baby A has to be head down, but if her care provider says, oh, sure, 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 it's kind of like the VBAC, oh, sure, 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 I'm going to do vaginal twin as long as baby A is down. But then they start to get in close to their due date, and all of a sudden there's, again, a little bait and switch. What can the mom do? Or let's just talk your thoughts about vaginal twin.
Well, you've already nailed it. the key is to have a practitioner that you trust, that seems confident and comfortable in doing what they're doing. And again, the search for that has to be, there are Facebook groups where other, you know, like twin Facebook groups you can go on and people can give you their stories and you can find out the best practitioners in your area. I'm sure there's probably very large twin groups in New York.
Mm-hmm.
Because you want to find a practitioner that isn't going to do the bait and switch, that is comfortable. You know, doctors do that sort of thing at the beginning because they feel like, well, maybe something will happen that I can convince her to have a cesarean section. And then when nothing happens, then they're sort of stuck doing, you know, something they don't feel comfortable doing. And so they try to talk you out of it. And that's generally what happens. But in my own experience, if the first baby is what I call a longitudinal lie, which means either a head first baby or a breech baby in proper breech position, then my experience and the literature do support that woman having a vaginal trial of labor. There's no excuse if they're multiparous, if they've had babies before, of not giving that woman a chance. And even in primiparous women, if baby A is in a proper position, then they deserve a trial of labor. A skill that doctors need to know is what's called breech extraction or internal podalic version. They're not teaching these things as much anymore. So if baby B isn't also head down, they feel very uncomfortable doing a twin delivery, even if baby A is head down. And then there's no guarantee that even if baby B is head down, that once baby A comes out, that baby B will stay head down. And then you end up with somebody who's very uncomfortable, and you might end up with a vaginal delivery of twin A and a cesarean section for twin B. And that's happened before, too. And so I think the feeling is that there's a lot of belief that, why go through all this trouble? We'll just do a cesarean section. It'll take 40 minutes. You'll be in the hospital for a couple of days. You heard me say this earlier. Why would you want to risk anything for your babies? Okay? And that just depends. A lot of people, it depends. That's not bad advice if that's your only pregnancy you're ever going to have. You could think about it that way. All right? It's not necessarily the best for your babies, and it's certainly not necessarily the best for you, but it may be the simplest, easiest thing to do in a setting. However, if you plan to have another baby after that, or if you've already had a baby and you have a baby, a toddler that you have to take care of, why would you want to have a surgical birth? I just don't know that. But the biggest problem, as you said, is going to be in the coming years of finding practitioners who aren't retiring,
mm-hmm.
who are still willing to do these sorts of things. And this is the shame that I still place at the foot of the people that direct our residency programs. I don't know what their thinking is. Their job is to train future obstetricians, and they're not doing it. They're just not doing it.
They're making it a very narrow field. I want to ask a little bit for those that might be listening that are pregnant with twins, when they're hearing from their care provider it's risky, what kind of risks are they being quoted from their care provider about, oh, don't have a twin vaginal, it's risky?
Well, I think what they're quoting is that let's back step a bit here and just talk, the type of twin we're talking about are generally what we call dye twins. They're diamniotic, dichorionic twins, or what often are called fraternal twins in the lay world. Monodye twins also can have a vaginal birth. They're slightly at more risk for something called twin-twin transfusion syndrome, which is something that if it hasn't appeared by about 28 weeks, it's probably not likely to appear. You want the babies to be concordant in growth, which means within about 20% of each other. But that's also just a guideline. Sometimes I've seen pregnancies where at 8 weeks, one fetus is like 30% bigger than the other fetus. And all through the pregnancy, both fetuses are growing normally at their own growth curve, but one remains 30 to 35% bigger than the other fetus. By the standard of they have to be within 20%, that would mean you can't have a vaginal birth in that case. But that makes no sense because both babies are healthy. They're just growing at their different rate. So, you know, people with confidence can be flexible. People without confidence are often not very flexible. The risks that people are talking about are, well, the second twin, if it turns sideways or whatever else, there could be a cord prolapse. You have to go up and get it. The baby could come out a little bit suppressed or depressed. The likelihood that if you're delivering those babies in a hospital setting within an OR with an OR crew standing by, that you're going to end up with a baby that suffers a brain injury or some other life-threatening injury is going to be very, very small. There's a slight increased risk for other injuries, you know, transient injuries like a broken clavicle or a nerve injury to the arm or something like that. That can happen when you're manipulating a baby. But those, again, we're talking about the risks of doing something versus the risks of doing something else.
Mm-hmm.
So there is no risk-free
But I think you just touched upon something really important, is the risks are probably told, these are risks. But then on the other side, we're not necessarily saying the risks of a cesarean.
No, and there's risk to injury. There's risk to injury of babies born by cesarean section. And in the term breech trial, as a matter of fact, even though the rate of injury was higher in the vaginal breech delivery, the most severe injuries, the fractured necks and things like that, which are extremely rare, and I don't want your listeners to go off on a tangent with that, but the ones that were really bad actually were babies born breech by cesarean section, probably because the doctors didn't know what they were doing and were pulling on a baby and extended the head and pulled on the head and did things that – so doing a cesarean section for twins is not risk-free. It doesn't mean your babies will be born without risk, all right? So, again, finding skilled practitioners is the key, and the training is such that, you know, it's a paradox. Mm-hmm. I don't see how it gets better. It's very, very frustrating for someone like me who has the skills but yet is considered an outlier. Mm-hmm. How did someone who was trained to do all the things that make an obstetrician unique now become the outlier, and the standard is to do nothing, none of those things? I just don't know how that – I mean, I do know how it happened, but it's a rhetorical, how did that happen?
It makes me sad because, you know, I've been working, as mentioned, with pregnant women for 15 years, and I feel like things that I saw – the very first time I attended birth, before I was even a doula, I saw a twin vaginal birth. I had a student who was doing her fellowship at a hospital here, and she told her I was a med student, and I walked around seeing births. And it was a massive deal, and I didn't realize – this was more than 15 years ago at that point – I didn't realize what a big deal it was, but now it's just some of these things that I heard 15, 16 years ago are really starting to get smaller in choices. So even over this small period of time, I'm starting to see the options for women disappearing. And so we're just trying to give women the information so they can make informed choices and really weigh the risk versus benefits, which I think you've really laid out quite beautifully.
Yeah, someday we're going to look back on this era. I don't know if it'll be in my lifetime or not. And we're going to say, what were we thinking? What were we thinking about taking something as natural as growing a baby inside and allowing the primitive brain to do its thing and put you into labor and deliver that baby as nature intended, and thinking that we're doing a better job by taking the cesarean section rate up to 30-35%, even higher. In some countries like Brazil, it's 80%, 90%. I mean, it's an insanity. You know, in the United States in 1970, the C-section rate was 5%. And now it's 32%, which is a 500% increase in 40 years without any significant decrease in the incidence of anoxic brain injury or cerebral palsy or the things that supposedly, you know, fetal monitoring and labor curves and hospital stuff was going to take care of. So all we've done is we've increased the rate of cesarean section without any benefit to show for it. And what are we doing to future generations of women, and also of practitioners not being able to learn the skills that are necessary? And then there's one really big point that was made at the Breech Conference that I went to last year in Amsterdam. And I have to say it because people have to understand it. When an edict comes out in Western medicine, like, let's do cesarean sections for all breech, there's something called the number needed to treat. And it's a medical term that defines how many patients need to be treated to prevent one bad outcome. And for breech babies, the number needed to treat is 338. In other words, you have to do 338 cesarean sections to save one baby, okay? Now, I don't know how that rings with your listeners, but understand this. In the third world, Tanzania, for instance, the guy that spoke had been working in Tanzania, and he said that for every 338 cesarean sections you do in Tanzania, you kill 6 women.
Wow.
Okay. So when Western medicine comes out with this thing that's, oh, breech birth, we should stop teaching the skills. What you're doing is you're condemning, no one's looking long term. Mm-hmm. It's all what's called stage one thinking, right? We're not looking down the road. But in third world countries where surgical techniques and sterility and antibiotics and stuff are less available, you're going to end up with killing 6 mothers to save one baby. I mean, when you put it that way, everyone would look at you and say, that's ridiculous. But that's not ridiculous because that's what's being done. And so to not teach these skills is a huge crime.
It is. That's exactly the word I was thinking when you were about to say it, crime. And just disservice to the women. Wow. Okay, we gave our listeners a lot to chew on. Where can people find you if someone's listening and they're really resonating with what you're saying? Where can people find you? What are you up to?
Okay. Well, my website is birthinginstincts.com, and if you go there, and if you wanted to get, you can read through the, you know, they've got all kinds of stuff on there, including some videos and other things. But on the very top banner, there's this thing that says read, and you click on that, and it takes you to the paper that I wrote a couple years ago on home birth with an obstetrician. It's a series of 135 out-of-hospital births, and it gives you some really good data on what can be done with a skilled practitioner using a midwifery model of care. And I'm not saying that that's a thing you're going to take your doctor and argue with, but it's going to give you some information about things that can be done. Right now, I have a book called Fearless Pregnancy. It was the second edition was published in 2010. It's still really relevant today, other than the genetics chapter. So if anybody wants to go to fearlesspregnancy.net, I think it is, or click on the banner on my website and look at the book. I'm just warning you, the genetics chapter is obsolete now because genetic screening has changed so dramatically since the advent of what's called NIPT, or non-invasive prenatal testing, which wasn't around in 2010. I'm working on a new paper right now. I've got all my papers right here. And I'm going to try to publish a paper on home breech birthing and compare it to home headfirst birthing.
All right, well, I'm actually, I get a lot of your stuff from your website. I've subscribed to your Facebook page, so I'll keep an eye out for that when you get that paper out, and I'll just update our show notes. So once that's released, I'll see if I can.
Oh yeah, it'll be a while. If I'm doing a big talk in Boston.
Oh, that's
right. I'm doing a day with Dr. Stu, and I think it's October 7th or 8th in Boston, and there'll be more information on that coming out. And then I'm going to talk about, it's just me all day long, breeches, twins, VBACs, home birthing, my statistics, ethics, we're going to talk about informed consent.
I'm going to try to get to that. I'm from that area, so I can send my husband and the kids to my mom's, and maybe I can come in to attend that.
I'll keep you posted on that. And then I have a podcast, which people go on. Sometimes we get off the topic, but a lot of times we talk about relevant topics to obstetrics, but a lot of times we go off on current events or other things. Like whether I should send my daughter to Coachella or not, let her go to Coachella. But so that's at drstuspodcast.com. That's drstuspodcast.com.
Yeah, I'll put that. I'll make sure that's in our show notes too. I've listened to it. It's good.
And all those banners are on the website. So that's basically what you can get from me. I mean, I'm just plucking along. I'm trying to do what I can do. California is a funny state to live in, and people think of California as the free Beach Boys, you know, free love type state, but it's actually one of the most regulated, micromanaged states in the country, and they're still trying to restrict what midwives can do, and they may even try to eventually, I'll be collateral damage to that, and they'll restrict what I can do, so I may be looking down the road to, you know, to see a state that is a little more friendly, because I love to teach. I would love to get into an institution and teach breech birth, but I would just have a hard time, I think, going back working in a hospital mindset. I being out of the hospital for 7 years has been great for me, but I think that, you know, the rigidity and the restrictions and the regulations and the policies and the micromanaging and the one size fits all and the going to meetings that don't really mean anything and stuff like that. I guess I'm just too counterculture now to ever probably go back to that.
Well, you're doing a great service to help birth workers like myself help support women to find doctors and care providers that support birth off the beaten path, I guess I could say, you know, not the hospital norm. I want to thank you so much for your time and for your work. I really appreciate that. I know you're on Pacific time, so I know we had a little bit of a hiccup with organizing ourselves, but I really appreciate all the time you've given and again, all the work you do.
Thank you, Deborah.
Thanks. All right. I got to wake my daughter up from her nap.
I got to go to the office. So it's been a pleasure.
Pleasure speaking.
To all your listeners, you know, just keep looking for information. Keep digging. Don't necessarily accept things at face value. Don't accept a physician who gives you grief if you ask questions. Don't do it.
Wonderful. Have a great day. Take care. Thanks.
Okay. Bye-bye.
Bye.
This has been an episode of Yoga Birth Babies, produced by Prenatal Yoga Center. You can catch us on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and Periscope. I'm Deb Flaschenberg. Thanks for listening.